This morning, we are going to continue our study in Mark's Gospel. We are in Mark chapter 12, and we will focus on verses 38 to 44. Let me just set a little context for you. If you haven't been here in a while, or you're new this morning, or you just don't know where we are in Mark, let me set this up for you. We are looking at Mark's Gospel. We're in chapter 12. There's 16 chapters in this Gospel, so we're in the last third. But Mark basically dedicates the last third of his Gospel to really one week of Jesus' life, and it's the week that precedes the crucifixion, and it includes the crucifixion. So that particular week is a real emphasis in Mark's Gospel. And we've been looking in the last, I think it's five sermons now, at one particular day of that week, and it's the Tuesday. Jesus came into Jerusalem in a show of glorious kingship, I guess I'm going to call it. We call that Palm Sunday. He came on the little donkey down the hillside from the Mount of Olives so that all of Jerusalem could see who he was. On Monday morning, he came into the temple, and there he did the second of the cleansings, where he basically chased out all those people. And what he was doing was providing prophetic signs, saying that everything was about to change dramatically in the way the Jews and Jerusalem and Israel understood their relationship with God. And then he comes back on Tuesday, and remember, we're progressing towards Good Friday and Resurrection Sunday, but the Tuesday he spends in the temple, and it's just a day of confrontations. The Jewish authorities are challenging Jesus, and he in turn counter-challenges them. And it's really sort of a show of who has God's authority in this situation. And you can really understand as you see the challenges put before Jesus where he has authority to answer, and then you see as Jesus counter-challenges them where he has the authority to demand loyalty from them. So this is probably the last confrontation of the day, the passage we're looking at here. It's either confrontation number five or six, depending on how you want to count them. And what Jesus will do in this final confrontation on that Tuesday is he's going to make a very important public statement, and then he is also going to provide an object lesson. And what it's really all about here is, if you remember the last passage we looked at, Jesus was challenged by a more or less honest scribe who said, which is the foremost commandment? Which is the greatest one? And Jesus' response was from Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 4 and 5. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is Yahweh alone. We only have one God, and we pledge our allegiance to him. And then he goes on, he adds verse 5 into that, and he says, devotion amounts to this. You love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. And then just for good measure, and actually as a bonus, Jesus gives the second greatest commandment, because the scribe had only asked for one. And he says, and then from Leviticus chapter 19, you also need to love your neighbor as yourself. And we said last week that actually, if you understand and practice devotion to God as he wants it to be, loving him with the totality of your being, that kind of love will not be contained in you. You will have to have that kind of love overflow and spread to others as well. And so all of a sudden, the relationships that you have with the human beings in this world are going to change because of the great relationship that you have with God. The incredible vertical relationship has tremendous horizontal implications. All right. Last confrontation of the day. There is a large crowd, according to our text from verse 37 of Mark 12, listening to Jesus and enjoying him speaking. I don't know if they were enjoying watching the scribes getting put in their place or not, but they were enjoying listening to Jesus speaking. And the scribe who had challenged Jesus about the most important of the commandments, we're not sure if he's still there or not, but now Jesus turns his attention not to that particular scribe, but to the category of scribes as a whole. He's going to sort of do a generalization of what scribes are like. Remember, we have said, and Jesus has said, what's the most important commandment? Love the Lord. The Lord our God, it's him alone. Total devotion, total loyalty, total love. Now, what does that look like? Guess it really depends on who wants to define this. We as human beings are creatures of perception. We see, we hear, and then we decide on what we've seen and heard as to what's going on here. Israel had a concept of devotion to God. Sometimes we call that piety. Have you heard that word before? If you're pious, it means you're godly. Israel had a concept of piety, and it was regularly displayed for them, and it was regularly declared to them by a particular group of people. And this particular group of people are the scribes. Now, what did it mean to be a scribe and to model piety and devotion to Israel? Well, we're going to look at that this morning. What we are going to see is that Jesus did not agree with the way that the scribes portrayed and projected and presented devotion to God. And that's kind of the snag that we have here, is because we in our humanness and we in our society and our culture have defined devotion to God one way, but we really need to ask the question, is this how God defines devotion to him? Because it's not so important that we are happy with what we offer to God. It is much more important whether or not God is honored and pleased with what we offer to him. Now, we need to consider something here this morning. When Jesus makes comment on what true devotion to God is this significant comment? Well, Jesus was a good teacher. Jesus was a righteous man. Oh, please, don't stop it there. According to Mark chapter 1, verse 1, when we start this gospel, who is Jesus? It's the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. To be the Son of God means that you are God. So when Jesus speaks about devotion to God, he actually sets the real standard of what that means and what God expects. How does this need to be understood? You see, in that day, many claimed and tried to project devotion to God. And many in our day claim and try to project devotion to God. But the question maybe that we really need to ask is it legitimate? Is it true? Is this what devotion to God truly looks like? And is this how devotion to God truly lives? So when we look here at Mark chapter 12, we're going to finish off Mark chapter 12 this morning. Again, see that Jesus is going to make a statement on how we perceive devotion to God, and then see how Jesus is going to provide a rather sharp contrast in terms of a direct example. So we're going to look at some teaching, and then we're going to look at the passage that's often referred to as the widow's mites. All right, so let me read for you the passage, then I'll give you an outline, and then we'll spend some time going through it verse by verse and word by word. So, Mark chapter 12, beginning at verse 38. We're referring to Jesus here. It says, in his teaching, he was saying, beware of the scribes, who like to walk around in long robes, and like respectful greetings in the marketplaces, and like the chief seats in the synagogues and the places of honor at the banquets, who devour widows' houses, and for appearance sake offer long prayers. These will receive greater condemnation. And he sat down opposite the treasury and began observing how the people were putting money into the treasury, and many rich people were putting in large sums. And a poor widow came and put in 2 small copper coins, which amount to a cent. And calling his disciples to him, he said to them, truly I say to you, this poor widow put in more than all the contributors to the treasury. For they all put in out of their surplus, but she, out of her poverty, put in all she owned and all she had to live on. All right. This morning, I think we want to look at this passage and we want to learn what indeed is a proper perspective on devotion to God. Everybody seems to have their own opinion and everybody wants to define it, but from God's perspective, what actually is devotion that he's looking for from his people? So the first point we want to look at this morning will be from verses 38 to 40, and it's this, that false projections of devotion, false projections of devotion to God need to be seen for what they truly are. God's people need to learn to be discerning so that they can distinguish between false piety and true devotion and love to the God of gods and the King of kings, the Lord of lords. Secondly, a proper perspective on devotion to God is that God does not see devotion to him as the world so often perceives it. The world thinks, hey, that is real devotion to God. Does God see it the same way? And actually, God does not see it the way the world sees it. That's verses 41 to 42. And the third thing we'll look at this morning is that a proper perspective on devotion to God is not measured by the size of the gift, but it's measured rather by the depth of the love from which it was given. What was behind the gift? Not the gift itself, but what was behind the gift? And we'll look at that in verses 43 and 44. So back now to verse 38. In his teaching, he was saying, beware of the scribes. Now, we know from verse 37, which was the last verse that we looked at last week, that a large crowd had gathered. Just how large do you think the crowd was in the temple precincts around Passover? Normally, Jerusalem was a large city in its day. And in the ancient world, if you had a city of 200,000 people, which we often think Jerusalem was, that's considered a large city in those days. But Josephus, the historian, tells us that often when it was Passover, the priests would sacrifice up to 250,000 lambs. The law of God said that when a Passover lamb was sacrificed, it was designed that 10 people would eat one lamb. 250,000 lambs means that you got 2.5 million pilgrims at Passover. A city that normally holds 200,000 has got 10 times its population. Can you imagine Vancouver with 1 million people having 10 million people in it? How big are the crowds? They are huge. This is a glorious audience for Jesus to speak to, and he's going to speak to them. I think that moving around in the temple, you must have been shoulder to shoulder and just about cheek to cheek in there. It would have been so tight. It's a big space, but 2.5 million people is a lot of people. Jesus is using these temple courts as a lecture hall, and this is so appropriate because even though he had declared that the leaders of the temple had turned it into a hideout for robbers and a den of thieves, Jesus was turning the temple into a wonderful place to declare the real truth about God. That's what the temple was designed for. In his teaching, Jesus was saying, notice that this is not a one-time thing. He was actually repeating this. He was saying this fairly regularly. And what is he saying regularly? He is saying, beware. The little word there in the Greek means watch out. Keep your eye peeled for this. See and understand what's going on. Make a discerning call when you observe what's happening here. Beware. And here he's, and this is a plural, he's telling the whole crowd they need to beware of something. Who do they need to beware of? The scribes. Oh boy, here we go. I said this is Confrontation Tuesday. Another confrontation. When you tell the scribes that they got to watch out for the most pious men in Jerusalem, you're really kind of setting the wheels in motion here. There's going to be somebody not happy with you. Beware of the scribes. Now, we're talking about them as a group. There may have been some scribes that were more real, truly pious than others, but as a group, the scribes kind of fell into this categorization, into this generalization. They like to walk around. What are we talking about here? Well, if you have a young child and they like to dress up and they can find a big mirror in your house and they, you know, parade themselves around in front of the mirror, then they're not satisfied with that. They kind of parade themselves around in front of the family or the neighborhood or wherever they go. It's the whole idea of drawing attention to yourself. You are the parade. Everyone should watch you. That's what the scribes are doing here. They like to walk around. And you really want to do this at Passover. Why? Because there's lots of people to watch you. What do they like to do? Well, four ways Jesus describes them. Number one, they like to walk around in long robes. Now, lots of people wore long robes in those days, but what we're probably referring to here is a prayer shawl. You would call it a tallit, a really long shawl. If you had it over your shoulders, it draped virtually all the way down to the ground, and on the four corners, there were four tassels. And this was a thing that was normally only brought out in the synagogue for the official time of prayer. You would put on your tallit and you would begin to pray. I've been to the synagogues, I've seen them pull out the tallit and put it on. It's a little bit odd to see somebody strolling through the middle of town wearing a tallit. What are they trying to do? They are trying to show you just how pious they are. Now, I don't know about how many of you have ever been to graduations, you know, from a college or a seminary or wherever, and I always get a chuckle out of these things because the academics up at the front all like to wear their academic finery. So if you've got a bachelor's degree, you get one of these black robes, maybe a little mortarboard on the top for a hat. If you have a graduate degree, a master's level, you get your black robe and then you wear a big mantle cape on top of that. That tells everybody that you have that level of achievement. And of course, if you are a doctor, you wear a different kind of robe altogether. Now the colors get wild. Purples and oranges and pinks, and you get three bars on your arms and a hat on the top. And it's one thing to have this kind of pomp and circumstance at a graduation ceremony, but can you imagine a guy kind of walking through the streets, all decked out in his finery? That's what these guys were doing. Why are they doing that? So that people would think that they are devoted to God and they are pious. They are projecting their piety. They walk around in long robes. They like respectful greetings in the marketplaces. Now, what's really interesting about this is that the scribes had basically trained the populace to the point where if they came into your presence, whatever you were doing, you had to stop and rise in their honor. So when you come through in your fancy tallit, everybody has to stop. Oh. Thankfully, the tradesman didn't have to do that because you'd hate somebody to stop in the middle of something important or dangerous, but everybody else had to stop. This is the respectful greetings in the marketplaces. And why are you in the marketplaces? You would go there so that lots and lots of people could see you. Do you notice a little ego attached to this thing here? Yeah, just a bit. And they like, that still controls verse 39, and they like the chief seats in the synagogue. You had some important seats at the synagogue. Can you imagine that those who really thought they were really pious would come and put their chairs up on the platform area here so that you could see them and they could see you as the service went on? That's what was going on there. Boy, no ego problems here. And they like places of honor at the banquets. Can you see the sadness of this? These are the scribes, and this is what was passing for devotion to God and piety in Israel. Think it's appropriate that Jesus would address this? Absolutely. Now, Jesus has talked about what it means to be his disciple back in chapter 8, verse 34. You should have these three things just about memorized by now. What are the requirements of discipleship? Requirement number one, deny self. Do you see any denying of self in the scribes? Oh, this is just all declaring and aggrandizing of self. What's the second thing in the requirement of discipleship? What's the idea of carrying your cross? But I've defined that for you as extreme self-humbling. The cross was always designed to be the most humbling thing, humiliating thing that could ever happen to a person. Jesus says you take up your own cross, you practice extreme self-humbling. You see any extreme self-humbling in the scribes here? Anything but. They're on the opposite end of the continuum. You see, the question you have to ask yourself here is, Jesus has just finished talking about the greatest commandment. The greatest commandment was loyalty to God and devotion to God with everything, all the four alls. Do you see anybody here loving God with all their heart, their soul, their mind, and their strength? Or do you see the scribes here as loving themselves? You know what? Is this a hard call to make? Not really. You should be able to see this clearly. And yet these were the models of godly devotion presented to Israel. By the way, if these guys utterly fail to keep the first greatest commandment, which is loving God, how do you think they do with the second greatest commandment, loving neighbor as self? said before, that vertical relationship drives the horizontal. Well, you know what? There wasn't much of a vertical relationship there. So therefore, what do you think the horizontal relationship is doing? Verse 40 tells you, who devour widows' houses. How do you devour a house? I mean, I've been hungry, but never really thought about chewing on plaster and studs. Obviously, we're talking somewhat symbolically here. Let me tell you different ways you could understand this. The scribes who were to be the teachers of Israel did not have an official paycheck. But it was expected that the people of Israel would be so thrilled with their teaching and would hold them in such esteem and such honor that they would automatically extend to them the very best in hospitality. So when a scribe came down the street, you took out that really good roast you had been saving and you popped it in the oven, because he might drop by for dinner. And if you've got a guest room, you give him the best room or the best bed in the house, whatever the case may be. What we understand here when it talks about who devour widows' houses is that these scribes were actually sponging off. You know that expression? Sponge, kind of sucking all the good stuff out. They were sponging off of widows because they couldn't charge for their teaching, but they could expect hospitality. They really took advantage. And the sad thing is, were the widows the wealthy class of Israel? No. The widows are usually the poor class of Israel. Now think back to Elijah with the widow at Zarephath. He comes to her. There's a famine going on. He wants hospitality. She says, well, I've got enough flour here to make one more meal for my son and I, and then we'll die. But she invites in Elijah, and she makes food for him. And what happens, by the way, to her supply of flour and oil? It just never runs out. Was Elijah taking advantage of her? Actually, the reality was Elijah was sent by God to supply her, but she needed to be hospitable, and she was. Now, this is different than what these scribes are doing. It's the opposite. On the other hand, these scribes were often involved in legal matters, and often they were called in to settle estates for widows. Now, when you're settling estates for widows, you can also siphon off a little of the cash to yourself. So that way they could be devouring the widow's household. Then again, there's another way you can understand this. And Mark is writing this gospel somewhere around 70 AD. He's writing to a basically Roman audience. And Josephus, the historian, tells us about something that had happened in Rome in the days of Jesus, when Tiberius was the emperor. What had happened was, in Rome, there was a particular man who called himself a scribe of Israel and had managed to befriend a Roman woman citizen who had a considerable estate. Her name was Fulvia, and he had convinced this woman that to truly honor God, she should be sending basically all that she had as a gift to the Jewish temple in Jerusalem. Only problem with this is that this unnamed scribe never actually sent the money to Jerusalem. He pocketed it for himself. Josephus records that this was so well known in Rome that it was a scandal from Tiberius the emperor down to the most basic plebe on the streets of Rome. Everybody knew about this crooked scribe who had stolen everything and embezzled from this widow. The devouring of the widow's house. Not only does this show that there is no love for neighbor, if this is what is happening, but when you consider the Old Testament, please understand what Isaiah chapter 10, verses 1 to 4 says about widows. And since the scribes are the keepers of the law of Israel and the teachers of the law of Israel, they probably even had this memorized. They should have understood Isaiah chapter 10. Let me read it for you. It says, woe to those who make unjust laws, and to those who issue oppressive decrees to deprive the poor of their rights and rob my oppressed people of justice, making widows their prey. Specifically targeting widows and robbing the fatherless. By the way, God takes it as especially offensive when instead of loving the disadvantaged, you target the disadvantaged. Let me continue to read. For those who have done this, here come some questions. What will you do on the day of reckoning if you have robbed widows and preyed upon them? What will you do when the day of disaster comes from afar? To whom will you run for help? Where will you leave your riches? Yes, you have managed to steal from them, but this is going to be a big problem that you've stolen. You've got that money. Nothing will remain but to cringe among the captives or to fall among the slain. But notice the next phrase. And even if you do cringe among the captives and fall among the slain, yet for all this, God's anger is not turned away and his hand is still upraised. This is a rather severe warning to those who would take advantage of widows and orphans. The Lord's hand is up there and it don't matter what happened, boy, it's coming down with a boom. Not only do they devour widows' houses, please note the next phrase, and for appearance sake, offer long prayers. I'm not opposed to those who pray long prayers, as long as they're actually addressing themselves to God. I am not impressed by those who pray long prayers because they think they're impressing their human audience. By the way, when Jesus teaches, what does he say about prayer? He says, don't think that the Lord is impressed because you've got lots of words. He doesn't look for meaningless repetition. You're speaking to the God of gods, the King of kings. He knows what's going on. You can't impress him by that kind of stuff. By the way, what happens? These will receive greater condemnation. A nice dynamic way to translate this is that they will receive punishment in the extreme. Ouch. Now, stop for a moment and consider this. Is there such a thing as a false projection of devotion that God shall not deal with? Devotion to God is so important. It is the chief of the commandments. But pretending to be devoted to God for the sake of trying to impress other human beings, that is just the worst thing you could ever get yourself caught up in. You see, God sees the truth. But what was happening in Israel, for whatever reason, it was, according to Jesus, his concern seems to be that the people of God are not perceiving the difference between true devotion and this false projection of devotion. That's why he says, beware, watch out, judge wisely, and for heaven's sake, don't follow what they're doing. We've got the first point here this morning. False projections of devotion to God need to be seen for what they truly are. You see, God sees it, and he's just never fooled by it. And it's even worse to follow such an example. Those who are given the opportunity and the privilege of leadership need to be really, really clear on this, that you do not lead the people of God astray by false projections of devotion and piety. That's the first thing that Jesus has to say in that particular confrontation. Now, what's interesting here is that in each portion of this passage this morning, we've got three of them, it's always Jesus who takes the initiative. It's in his teaching he was saying this. Now in verse 41, he changes his location and he goes and he sits outside of the temple treasury to observe what's going on. And then in the third portion, he will then call his disciples to him and he will make an application based on the observation. So Jesus is really taking the initiative in all three of these things, and he's going to make a pronouncement in the last two verses. So look at verse 41. It says, and he, of course, we're still talking about Jesus, sat down opposite the treasury and began observing how the people were putting money into the treasury. Now let me describe the temple in those days. The temple actually had a series of courts and grounds around it. There were the colonnades of Solomon, which were sort of the outside courts. You got some relief from the sun there. They were covered. And then as you got into the temple, there was sort of the Temple Mount area. As you got towards the temple proper, the first gated and walled area was the court of the Gentiles. All right? This was supposedly reserved for those who were not part of Israel but wanted to be involved in the worship of the God of Israel. Then after that, there was a gate and there was a second court. And this was the court of the Jewish women. After that, there was another gate and there was another court. And so this is sort of, you know, outside and then inside and then inside and inside. There was the court of the Jewish men. Then there was the court of the priests. And then there was the sanctuary, the Holy of Holies in the middle. Here we are in the court of the Jewish women, because in the court of the Jewish women, that's where the temple treasury was. Now let me talk for a little bit about the temple treasury. This is not only the place that kept the offerings of God's people towards God's kingdom, but this was also the best bank in town. Think back in the ancient world. Where could you deposit your money where it would be safe? No royal bank, no Envision Credit Union, no, you know, ATM. You got people who steal, you got, you know, where do you keep your cash? Well, actually, a great deal of people kept their cash at the temple treasury. It was a secure place. It was inside the temple grounds. They had a temple police force that was attached to it. And what was also attached right on the outside, not officially on the temple grounds, but right beside it, sort of on the north side of the temple. I'm picturing this in my mind from what I saw a year and a half ago. There's a little place called the Fortress of Antonia. What is the Fortress of Antonia? This is the barracks and the headquarters of the Roman legion, at least 6,000 soldiers, who made sure that Jerusalem kept the peace. This is actually within a couple of baseball throws of the temple. This is a safe place. So when you got people coming to the treasury here, man, they're not only putting in their gifts to God, but they're keeping their life savings in there. Now, I want you to understand exactly how much money this treasury had. When the Romans came in and destroyed Jerusalem in 70 AD, of course, they got to take the temple treasury. If you get to go to Rome someday, one of the sites you'll probably go and see is the Colosseum. The Colosseum employed 250,000 Romans for a period of almost 10 years to build. You know where the financing came for that? Temple treasury. There was enough money in the temple treasury to build the Colosseum to keep 250,000 people paid for 10 years. There's a lot of money in here. You come into the court of the women, you want to bring your offering. You go to a specific place and there are 13 collection boxes. They are called shofars. In other words, they're shaped like a ram's horn. They're big at the top, small at the bottom, or depending on who you talk to, they had them flipped upside down so that they were small at the top and big at the bottom. Some people think for security, they were small at the top, so you couldn't put your arm back down to get your money back out. Some people think for the lovely noise they made, they were big at the top and small at the bottom, so that when you threw in your money, it kind of echoed. You have 13 of these things, and they're designated for different purposes. Some of them are designated for free will offerings. Some of them are designated for priestly support. Some of them are designated for the continuing ministry of the temple, for the purchasing of the sacrifices that they needed to produce every day there, or offer every day there. And then some of them are basically just for the upkeep of the building. And when you would go in, there would probably be a scribe there, and you would tell him what your offering was, and he would direct you towards the appropriate offering box to throw it into. And we think that when he sent you to that, he would speak in a nice, loud, booming voice so that anybody who was nearby and paying attention really knew where your offering was going to. So, you know, Saul of Tarsus offers 200 denarii, and it's going to offerings. And then he would come and throw his money in. Jesus sat down opposite the treasury. He began observing how the people were putting money into the treasury and how many rich people were putting in large sums. And by the way, if the scribes are setting the tone for religious devotion in those days, don't you want your offering to be mentioned out loud so that people can look at you and think well of you too? So as these large sums are going in, Credit is being given. Now, what I love is this contrast. Oh, by the way, Jesus is sitting there, and he's observing. Is he just watching? Oh, no, he's taking note. He's judging what's going on, and he will make a statement about this. By the way, can I suggest to you that God is always, always watching? I don't know why we think sometimes he's not watching us. I don't know why we develop, you know, clever lies and justifications and excuses. The Lord of Lords is watching us. That should actually really revolutionize the way we live to some extent. Here Jesus is watching, and all of a sudden he's waiting, I think, for one particular individual to come. Verse 42. And a poor widow came and put in two small copper coins, which amount to a cent. Now she also has to go up to this scribe and say, where do I put this? A cent. General upkeep of the temple. Notice the contrast, please. Verse 41, there were many rich. There is one poor widow. Large sums come from the many rich. Two copper coins come from the widow. They're called leptha. And actually, what Mark does here is he explains and he puts an equivalency for his Roman readers. He says they amount to a quadrin, a cent. Now, in those days, let's put this into a BC equivalent. Minimum wage here in BC is about $10 an hour. If you're a laborer and you're making 10 bucks an hour, you work for 8 hours, you got 80 bucks. In those days, a quadrin, or two copper coins, amounted to 1/64th of a day laborer's wage. 1/64th of a denarii. So translate that down, we're talking about a buck and a quarter here. From a human perspective, what's important? The big gifts from the big givers, or the buck and the quarter from the poor widow? I have a question for you this morning. Is she tithing, by the way? Well, no. So we're getting down here. If tithing is 100%, then she's tithing. I'm not against tithing. I think tithing is a wonderful thing. But I got to ask myself this question. You can ask yourself this question. I won't try to make you feel guilty. I guess you can make me feel guilty. That's fair game. Does devotion to the Lord stop at the tithe? What did we have last passage? Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your mind, with all your soul, with all your strength, and with 10% of your money. Is that how it reads? No. Funny how human beings work. We always want to put some limits on what God could expect of us or what God should do to us. So, you know, we start asking questions, were we talking the net or the gross here, Pastor? We talking amount or percentage here, Pastor? Well, in case of the amount, a buck and a quarter isn't a big amount. In terms of percentage, what is Jesus going to say? It's the whole shebang. It's everything she's got. I guess I look at this and I ask the question, how much devotion does God really expect of his people? Now you can say, well, you know, that's an old covenant thing. That whole loving the Lord your God with all your heart, your soul, your mind, your strength. That's not a new covenant thing. Really? I think loving the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your mind, with all your soul, your all strength, that's just truth that fits into both covenants. I would suggest that if you want to put a limitation on all your resources, you're missing the point of the greatest commandment. And what we want to see here is that Jesus is watching very carefully. Jesus is judging, and Jesus will make a judgment call or a statement here. You see, the second point is, just from those two verses, God does not see devotion to him as humans often do. When God wants us to be devoted to him, You notice that he sets no limits and there's no qualifications. He really does expect his people to be utterly, totally, unreservedly, unrestrictedly devoted to him. By the way, somebody asked me this one time, if God has your whole heart, does he have your checkbook too? The answer actually is, yeah, he does. But we as human beings want to put limits on it. I've told this little story before. A little boy was going to Sunday school. Some of you can probably continue it from that point. And his mother gave him 2 quarters that day. And she said, son, one of these quarters is for the offering at church, and one of these quarters is yours to keep. And like little boys do, he was walking to church and playing with his 2 quarters, and one fell out of his hand and immediately fell and went into a sewer grate, and it was gone. And the little boy looked up and said, oh, Lord, I've lost your quarter. Because as human beings, it's always God's problem. I don't know, that just always speaks to me. Both the quarters belong to the Lord. But why would we as human beings want to put limits and say, oh, any loss, Lord, is yours. Any gain is ours. Anyway, reality here is that Jesus was watching and God is always watching. And that's a wise thing to keep in mind. Not that you should be terrified of that, but that it should just keep you on a real nice, honest, even keel. The Lord is always watching. That's a good thing. We like it when we're in trouble that he's always watching. It's when we're trying to be sneaky that we don't like it that he's always watching. Anyway, verse 43. Calling his disciples to him. Now, Jesus has been waiting for this gal to come. I assume he knows because he's omniscient, and she comes. And then he calls his disciples to him, and perhaps they had been listening too. And can you imagine the contrast of, you know, big offering, big gift, big offering, big gift, 1 cent. You could hardly miss that. Calling his disciples to them, he said to them, truly I say to you. Now, whenever Jesus says that, what do you need to do? Well, number one, you need to pay attention to what he's saying. But when he says, truly I say to you, he's going to say something probably new that's not commonly thought of by human beings. He's going to correct some false teaching, and he's going to give you something that you really need to focus on. Truly I say to you, this poor widow, oh, there's a problem right there. Now, I said before that the scribes, who are the keepers of the law and the teachers of the law, these greatly educated individuals, should have understood not only Isaiah chapter 10, where you don't dare leech off a widow or sponge off a widow, but even more than that, the fact that Israel in those days that had a treasury that was literally bulging with cash should have poor widows. Let me let you into a little teaching here. Deuteronomy chapter 14, verse 28. Deuteronomy is that second teaching of the law before Israel goes into the promised land. How is Israel supposed to operate? Well, they take tithes, do they not? You bring your tithe in, and it goes towards supporting the temple and the priesthood. The Levites didn't have land of their own, so the tithe was what they lived off of. But according to Deuteronomy 14:28, for 2 years in a row, you would bring your tithes, and they would be used for the religious support of Israel, for the tabernacle and later for the temple. But every third tithe, every third year, that tithe was to actually stay in your own hometown. You didn't bring it into the temple. You put it into a repository, and from that money, you made sure that there was no poor among you. No poor orphan, no poor alien living among you, no poor widow living among you. And if you consider that one tithe out of every three was going to go towards this, do you think there should have been enough money in Israel to effectively make sure that the disadvantaged were not in poverty? Absolutely. Every third tithe was designed to make sure that the family did well. Why was this so important? You need to understand Israel's place in the world. Who was Israel? God's people. In other words, what Israel did not only reflected on the nation of Israel, but what Israel did reflected upon whom? Who did they represent? Who did they present to the world? Their God. This is a God of justice. This is a God of compassion. This is a God of holiness. You see, Israel was never commanded to take the gospel and go out throughout the world and preach. They were not a proselytizing nation. But what were they? They were a living example of how God expected his people to function and operate. The rest of the world was to look at Israel and say, they have the real God based on two things. Number one, how they love their God and how devoted they are to him, and based on how they love one another and look after each other. By the way, we only really read of one royal dignitary that ever came to Israel and understood this, and it was in the reign of Solomon. And who came to visit? The Queen of Sheba. But Israel was to be a living testimony of what God was all about in the midst of his people. You see, when there are poor among Israel, that means that the God of Israel is incapable of providing for his people. Is that the case? Not when the temple treasury is bulging and you can build a coliseum and employ 2.5 million people. Why is there a poor widow? Well, you've got the problem that they're taken advantage of by the supposedly pious ones, the scribes. This is really a condemning, damning comment here, is it not? In no way should this have been happening, because God sees and God knows. And had 1/3 of Israel's wealth been used for the welfare of its people, it would have been a remarkably different thing. There's no way that there should be poverty cases in Israel in that day or in this day. There's enough there, and if they are truly representing their God, they need to be doing the right thing. You see, devotion to God is not measured by the size of the gift. Now look at what Jesus says. Truly I say to you, this poor widow put in all more. That word is a cumulative word there. You add up all the donations of that day, and this one gal with her 1.25 put in more. Boy, talk about an unbelievable contrast that he's establishing here. She put in more than all the contributors to the treasury, for they all put in out of their surplus. But she, three things, out of her poverty, put in all she owned and all she had to live on. If I was that widow, I would have said, I've got 2 lepta. Oh, Lord, here's your lepta. And here's the one I keep. By the way, you know how much a lepta bought? A palm full of flour. Her 2 leptas together didn't make up a happy meal at McDonald's. She gave out of her poverty, she put in all she owned, all she had to live on. Wow. What are the disciples thinking? Well, if they're looking through human eyes, they're looking at the size of the gift, and they're going, Lord, the 1.25? Really? Is it that big a deal? Well, it is to God. Because he sees the depth of love in the heart that gives the gift. See, the Lord doesn't need our money. We think he does. What the Lord is looking for is the unreserved devotion of his people. That's what brings him joy. That's what brings him glory. That's what actually makes the kingdom work, is this unconditional, unrestricted love. Boy, it just transforms absolutely everything. Love for God, and then love moving out. You know what's ironic about this? And I'm making the point that devotion to God is not measured by the size of the gift, but rather by the depth of the love from which it was given. Ironically, in chapter 14 of Mark, we got one chapter to go, we're going to see Jesus get an unbelievably extravagant gift. The widow had a buck and a quarter that went into the offering. But Jesus is going to get a jar of perfume poured on him that's going to be worth $25,000. $25,000 worth of perfume was poured upon Jesus. And were people happy because it was a big gift? No! They were upset because it was too extravagant a gift. You see, you look at the amount and you say, too little a gift, too big a gift. In both cases, what did Jesus look at? The depth of the love of the heart that gave it. That is what we need to understand. What is really interesting is that last little phrase here in verse 44, all she had to live on. She has done what she could. You know what? When you've done what you could and you've given it all, have you not loved with all your heart and your soul, your mind, and your strength? This is such an odd example because it just doesn't fit within the piety patterns of Israel. It doesn't fit in our piety patterns either. But God knows. And what God desires is the heart that is totally committed to him. Because when he's got your heart, then he's got your money too. That's the beauty of this, isn't it? By the way, I am so thrilled to be able to go to Mexico with this great gift that I'm bringing with me. It's a generous gift, which tells me that there must be need there. What a privilege to be able to go. I was kind of chuckling this week. I'm dealing with this passage, and in Bible 101, it was 2 Corinthians chapter 8 about giving generously, and I'm going to this, and I'm going, oh Lord, isn't it beautiful how you're just tying all this stuff together? May we be found worthy to extend the love of God to others. Three things to consider. Number one, we do need to distinguish between false projections of devotion to God and true devotion. We need to be practicers of true devotion. And those who are practicing false devotion, you know what? That's their problem. But please don't follow them. And there are lots nowadays who call for it to be followed. Secondly, we need to practice devotion to God on His terms. And His terms are all and all. We as human beings always want to set some limits. You know, you're much better off to just drop the limits and go with the alls. Practice devotion on God's terms. Thirdly, the depth of the love for God is always the true measure of every gift. This week, I will be asked again, because I've been asked this the last 7 years that I've gone, to the Torres family. Somewhere along the line, they will say, why do you love us? Why do you love us so much? I only have one answer for them ever. Because God loves us so much, we love so much, and give all the credit, not to us, no credit whatsoever to us, but this is the act of God who loves all of his children and loves through all of his children, and may you receive it and praise his glorious love. And I get to say that again this week. I know it's coming. One of the kids will maybe ask me. Oh, what a treat to share the love of God. That we, as part of the family of God, can reach out to another part of the family of God and say, know his love. What a treat.